from within. I can't shut it out or take flight. It's time to begin. I've got to stop hiding and make a stand here. Too long I've laid low, held back by depression and fear. And there's no use in crying over all that's been done. When we throw up our hands in despair, the monster has won. And I just can't ignore all the things that I've seen. There's right and there's wrong, black and white, and there's no in between.
Well, maybe a little bit of in between. Don't want to be an absolutist now.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 12th of December. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Moira Warburton. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:14 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
We also have a segment on report on a lawsuit against the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation for not complying with a new law requiring bands to post audited financial statements online as a part of the Financial Transparency Act.
And we also have our science and technology correspondent, Marco, who's going to be discussing this week's top science findings. Later on in the program, we'll also have a retrospective of the Hong Kong protests. And we'll also have Christine Kim in studio to report on plans to establish a global reporting center at UBC.
We also have news correspondent D.P. Lael documentary, We Are All Equal.
But first, for some headlines for today. In campus news, a new report further condemns UBC presidential travel expenses. Last year, we reported that UBC's former president, Stephen Toop, spent more money on travel expenses during his career than any other head of a post-secondary institution, more than doubling those of UFT and McGill presidents. According to a new report by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, or CTF, Taxpayers have paid for roughly $1.5 million in airfare and hotel expenses for post-secondary institutions in the past 2 years. The report, mockingly titled The Screwed You Dean's List of Waste, lists former President Toop's reimbursed airfare expenses at $250,000 with multiple trips to Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, California, Asia, and Europe. CTF's BC director, Jordan Bateman, was astonished to find just how much money was spent by these presidents, with little to no oversight. Bateman added that Toop's list of expenses were a, quote, U2 rock and roll tour, not a public servant schedule that should be paid by taxpayers. Following up the report, the CTF is now calling on Minister of Advanced Education, Amrik Virk, to order all post-secondary institution presidents and executives to post complete and detailed expense reports every financial quarter.
The Mayor's Council on Regional Transportation moves forward on new transportation and transit plan. The Council has approved a referendum question that will ask voters to answer yes or no to a 0.5% increase in the provincial sales tax in Metro Vancouver for transportation and transit improvement. The Mayor's Council said that the plan will lead to reduced transportation congestion throughout Metro Vancouver by creating new bus and rapid transit services and by improving existing roads and transit services. Increasing the regional provincial sales tax by 0.5% is estimated to cost around $125 for the average household. The Mayor's Office characterized the sales tax increase as the most equitable and stable of the funding sources available to regional and provincial governments. Over the past several months, UBC's AMS has been working to raise student awareness and engagement on issues that affect them directly, including public transit. The new transportation and transit plan guarantees a rail line along the Broadway corridor to service the 50,000 daily commuters to UBC's campus. In a press release, Bahare Jokar, AMS Vice President, External Affairs, said this, quote, is likely to be one of the most important public policy choices made by the voters. It is therefore imperative that all students make their voices heard by registering and voting at this occasion. In international news, Uber was banned in India due to allegations of a driver raping a passenger. Over the weekend, a driver employed by Uber allegedly raped his female passenger. In response, the Indian government has elected to ban the company from operating within its borders. This is the latest in a series of roadblocks the company is currently facing, with bans in Thailand, Spain, Netherlands, and Germany, as well as legal challenges closer to home in Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, California. The bans are mainly due to concerns over the lack of background checks on Uber's drivers. The company also does not require vehicles to be registered and has been characterized as an unlicensed taxi service. It is unknown how Uber will respond to these allegations or appeal the bans, but it is clear that the upstart transportation company has a bumpy road ahead.
Those are your campus, local, and national and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco with your weekly science and technology news. In our lead story, most of Earth's water comes from asteroids, not comets. So say scientists from the European Space Agency who landed the Rosetta lander, which was called Philae, on comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko on November 12th. In new data from the lander, it has now been determined that the water that seeded the Earth in its early years came from asteroids and not comets. 4.6 billion years ago, when the Earth formed, it was much too hot to host water. But about 4.1 to 3.8 billion years ago, the Earth was bombarded and pummeled by asteroids and comets in what is known as the late heavy bombardment. Scientists have always speculated, where did the water that is now on Earth come from? Did it come from asteroids which hit us, comets, and there are also two places in our solar system where asteroids come from. One place is the Oort cloud, a giant spherical cloud with trillions of comets. It is 5,000 to 100,000 times the distance that the Earth is from the Sun. The Oort cloud is the biggest thing in the solar system. There's also something called the Kuiper Belt, K-U-I-P-E-R, that is just inside the orbit of Neptune, where certain comets come from. And then there's the asteroid belt. Tests done on Comet 67P shows that a certain ratio of elements is three times higher the ratio of water on Earth. The ratio comprises of this: deuterium, which is heavy water, over the regular hydrogen, which makes up just our ordinary water. On Earth, there are thought to be three molecules of heavy water to every 10,000 molecules. But data 67P shows this ratio is 9 to 10,000. So now scientists have ruled out that comets seeded the early Earth with water. They now think asteroids did. In our second story, another one about space news, NASA's Orion spacecraft was recovered from the Pacific Ocean late last week. A flight that did not have any people on board took off from Cape Canaveral on December 9th in a four-hour flight. Spacecraft Orion blasted off in higher than a spacecraft has gone recently. It returned to the ocean in Mexico below Southern California and was retrieved by the U.S. warship USS Anchorage. Orion went 5,795 kilometers above Earth and faced temperatures of 2,200 degrees Celsius and speeds of 20,000 miles per hour. It landed 965 kilometers south of San Diego. Orion will be counted on one day, as it will be the spacecraft of the future to carry people to Mars and to retrieve a comet called Bennu and bring it to orbit around the moon. The next flight of Orion will be, next test flight will be in 4 years, and next human flight, or the first human flight of Orion, will be in 7 years. In other environmental news, a kind of a shocking story, but last year in a conference in Bangkok, Canada opted not to block international trade in 76 endangered species. So says the Canadian press in a story they reported this week. Recently released documents said our federal government put up reservations about restricting trade in 76 endangered species. The only one they did not put a reservation against was the trade in manatees. Cheryl Fink of the International Fund for Animal Welfare said, in quote, "It's unprecedented. No other country has ever taken such action. I can't think of any explanation for it." Canada opted out of all but one motion, which aims to protect the manatee. Over the 39-year history of this conference, Iceland has made 22 reservations through these 39 years, but the U.S. has not made any. So Canada, with its latest actions of opting out of 76 out of the 77 provisions, made international headlines. The Canadian government said, in quote, "Canada requires additional time to make changes for the protection measures." But Cheryl Fink of the International Wildlife Fund says, and quote, "Canada has been fighting a rearguard action on polar bear parts. Every country around the world wants to ban or restrict trade in polar bear parts, but Canada is adamant and refuses to." So this may explain Canada's actions. In our last story, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, from NASA, has now entered two robots into a challenge. One is in a robot competition for next year. One is called Surrogate. One is called RoboSimian. RoboSimian will compete in the finals after a six-month competition between the two. RoboSimian is more competitive. It has two arms, two heads, two cameras, seven sets of eyes, and it has strength in handling objects. It is ape-like and can climb. It has true climbing ability, and it can shoot out a 360-degree laser beam to map the surrounding area. RoboSimian could have been used in the Fukushima power plant to be sent into the power plant to shut down the plant or to close valves, but RoboSimian didn't exist then. So robots of the future may be used for this. This is Marco. You have listened to the latest science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We are going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have a report prepared by news correspondent Ty Groman. The federal government filed a lawsuit against the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation for not complying with the new law requiring bands to post audited financial statements online. This is part of the Financial Transparency Act. This act affects 582 First Nations, which are defined as an Indian band under the Indian Act. As of 2014, the Financial Transparency Act has added a new demand in which the bands must publish on a website the expenses of their chief and council. This legislation began in 2011 to support democratic and accountable First Nations governments. The Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation is not the only nation the government is suing for not using the website. They have also filed lawsuits with the Thunder Child, Ochapawache, the Sawridge and Cold Lake First Nations in Alberta, as well as Onion Lake First Nations in Saskatchewan. These six nations are being sued for not posting specific finances on a public website. The Athabasca Chipewyan Nation has strongly resisted the oil sands pollution in northern Alberta. First Nations spokesperson Ariel Derringer was asked if the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations activism against the oil sands made an impact on the lawsuit. She replied, quote, "I would say it does, indirectly." The Athabasca Nation marched with Leonardo DiCaprio and director Darren Aronofsky at a People's Climate March in New York in protest of the oil sands pollution surrounding their nation, which informed many people of the pollution happening in Alberta. Ariel Derringer also stated in regards to the lawsuit that, quote, "Legally, because it is law and on paper, we are a registered First Nation in Canada and are required to abide by the law. However, our nation has not received any federal funds for core operating budgets for close to 3 years. So when they talk about transparency of federal funds, this has very little to do with us." This past summer, the Athabasca Nation refused to participate in a hearing regarding the Trans-Canada Grand Rapids pipeline. The nation refused to attend due to the annoyance of the company's efforts to show little concern over their loss of hunting and fishing treaty rights due to the pipeline. In April, they refused to accept funding from the federal government due to all the regulations and monitoring that followed the funding. The nation has begun looking for alternative energy sources rather than relying on the oil and gas industry. It is currently trying to teach their youth traditional practices in order to maintain their culture, which does not use oil and gas as a resource. In September, the nation installed solar panels in order to use less gas and oil energy. Ariel Derringer recently spoke about the pollution and other effects that the oil sands are having on her nation's land. Derringer stated that the Hollyhock Social Change Institute that, quote, "It's a genocide. It's happening slowly, but we are dying off. We're still drinking the water, and we're eating the fish, but it's getting poisoned. One of the primary beliefs of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations culture is to live off the land. It is beginning to become difficult for the nation to retain its cultural practices and system of beliefs. Thank you, Ty, for that report. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam,
Nisiaya, and the Sakhuya, Tilitin, who must we must tell.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. For our next segment on the show, we have a retrospective of the Hong Kong protests compiled by news correspondent Rohit Joseph.
On Thursday, December 11th, the largest political resistance in Hong Kong's history since its handover to China from Britain came to an end. Hong Kong's Occupy movement began brewing this past summer. Frustration had been mounting since Beijing's ruling in August that voters would only be able to vote for their chief executive in 2017 from a list of pre-approved candidates. The protests got into full swing on September 28th, with thousands of activists taking the street and occupying key financial districts in Hong Kong, such as Central District, Admiralty, and Mong Kok. From the outset, Hong Kong's chief executive, C.Y. Leung, declared that the protests are illegal, which prompted an aggressive response from the local police. That evening, riot police used tear gas in an attempt to force the crowds back, causing a public outcry and only escalating tensions. Over the course of October, the protest camps took root with artwork immortalizing symbols of the protest, such as yellow umbrellas and ribbons, flourishing across the three key sites. On October 3rd, student leaders agreed to meet with Hong Kong's leader, Chief Executive C.Y. Leung, and engaged in talks. But chaos later erupted in Mong Kok, a busy working-class shopping district taken over by protesters, when government loyalist thugs attacked the demonstrators. Student leaders called off the talks a day later, accusing police of failing to act over violent attacks against them. On October 26th, Executive C.Y. Leung makes another statement that caused a lot of controversy. He criticized that if the protester demands for democracy were met, that poor people would dominate the elections. This statement drew further backlash against C.Y. Leung and only escalated the demands for his resignation among the majority of student protesters. In November, even more clashes between protesters and police took place. On November 18th, protesters attempted to storm Hong Kong's parliament, triggering clashes with police yet again, and court-ordered clearances went underway. On November 26th, hundreds of police cleared a protest site in Mong Kok district and reopened a main road. Just 2 days later, on November 30th, police used pepper spray to fend off hundreds of demonstrators trying to surround the government headquarters, with clashes spilling into the following day. Student leaders, including Joshua Wong, the teenage demonstrator who's become one of the faces of the protest movement, announced a hunger strike, which ended 4 days later. Finally, yesterday on December 11th, all of the protesters were cleared out, along with their tents and supplies that had been occupying Admiralty District for over 2.5 months. Hundreds of police officers, some armed with chainsaws and bolt cutters on Thursday, methodically dismantled barricades, tore down canopies, and removed banners in a day-long operation to shut the protest site, sprawled across a normally busy highway. Police said 249 people were arrested for unlawful assembly and obstructing police officers, bringing the total number of those detained since the movement began 75 days earlier to about 900. Quote, "People will come back again. They will come back with a stronger force," said Alex Chow, the Secretary General of the Hong Kong Federation of Students, who was arrested yesterday. According to the Canadian press, pro-democracy lawmakers say they would pressure the government in the legislature by blocking funding requests and the government's electoral reforms. Pro-democracy lawmaker Lee Chuk-yun said, quote, "A dialogue can only happen when we vote down the coming political reform package." And this was the last person to be arrested before the protest sites were cleared yesterday.
Thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
What is Japanese music exactly? Is it something like this?
Or like this?
Or maybe this?
Time to explore Japanese music with us.
Tune in to Radio Nachikan from 7 to 8 a.m. on the last Friday of every month to find out. Or you could just listen to hosts Chika and Bianca talk about, well, Japanese stuff.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Moira Warburton.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have Christine Kim in studio to report on plans to establish a global reporting center at UBC.
The Global Reporting Center, also known as the GRC, is projected to open September next year and will be the first major nonprofit organization in North America focused solely on global investigative and enterprise reporting. This organization all began with U.S. broadcast journalist and director of the School of Journalism at UBC, Peter Klein. He told the Globe and Mail in a recent article that the idea for the GRC began when he headed to Africa to cover the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. He needed extra production days, but was told his budget did not allow him to do so. Klein says, quote, "I really feel if you take the profit motive out of global journalism, you could have an exceptional global journalism. Really, it does come down to money," end quote. Thus, the idea for the Global Reporting Center began as an institution to produce in-depth journalism on complex international issues through the funding model of philanthropy. This ambitious idea is one that is well needed in the journalism field, as news organizations are continuing to adapt to the quote-unquote digital age. New structures for funding journalistic endeavors are crucial. Kelly Tuffhill, director of the University of King's College School of Journalism in Halifax, says, quote, "I think it's the central dominant issue of our age. It's not just about finding new sources of funding. It's about finding new business models that translate into long-term sustainability." Philanthropy has become quite a common source of funding for news organizations, as The Walrus, a magazine about Canada and its place in the world, is published by a charitable foundation, and Mother Jones, a news organization that specializes in investigative, political, and social justice reporting, is actually funded by an umbrella organization known as the Foundation for National Progress. A business plan for the GRC proposes an annual budget of $2.5 million, and while this can be raised through support from charity organizations or from crowdfunding, Peter Klein is not starting from a completely ground level. The Global Reporting Center will be an extension of UBC's International Reporting Program. This program sends 10 master students a year to report on neglected international issues. Some of these reports include illegal logging in Russia, Indonesia, and Cameroon, as well as the societal costs of the Thai shrimp industry. The program was set up in 2008 with a $1 million endowment from Allison Lawton's Mindset Social Innovation Foundation. With this endowment, the program will be funded for at least 10 years, and by 2018, Klein hopes that this program can come under the wing of the GRC. While Peter Klein has much more money to raise for this center, his previous successes with projects such as these are promising. Klein joined the UBC faculty in 2005 and in just 3 years launched the International Reporting Program. The next step with the success of this previous program is to expand it into the major nonprofit that is the GRC. Klein's decorated resume, with Emmy Awards and countless high-profile jobs, such as his time as a producer of the CBS News 60 Minutes producer, will undoubtedly help him land some of the support he needs to get the center up and running. However, on the topic of funding, Klein also recognizes the biases that can arise from a source of funding that is dependent on one or two donors. This is why Klein says, quote, "I think it's critical to have a really diverse kind of funding, so you can walk away if you have to. That's another reason why we are trying to endow this. Once it's endowed, it's arm's length. You can't pull the money if you don't like the story we do." End quote. The GRC will support the training of new global journalists and encourage the collaboration between journalists to produce in-depth reports on important global issues using new forms of media and diverse voices from raw material collected in the field.
Thank you, Christine. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we are proud to present D.P. Lael's radio documentary, We Are All Equal, produced by outgoing news director Morgan Yee. We Are All Equal explores the complex subject of living with a disability and incorporates the stories of three women in the Lower Mainland.
This is D.P. Lael for CITR News 101. I live with a rare disability called metatropic dwarfism. This medical condition, not a disease, mainly affects my joints and bones. As a result, I largely depend on the use of an electric wheelchair to get around. My experience as a wheelchair user prompted me to confront issues regarding accessibility in the form of a documentary, which aired on CITR in May 2014. It focused on mobility issues around the Lower Mainland and included interviews from all kinds of people, including City Hall representatives, project managers for new buildings, and disability program coordinators. However, this original documentary represented only a fraction of the wide range of topics related to disability. The process of completing it got me thinking about ability and disability on a wider scale. We live in a diverse world, and people with disabilities represent a significant part of our communities. On a day-to-day basis, we all pass by, interact with, or share public spaces with individuals living with a disability. But there is still a lot of confusion about how to broach the topic. How do you talk about disability? Which terms are politically correct? Which are not? How does one approach a person with a disability? This program aims to address such questions. To be fair, there actually is a lot of awareness about disability within modern-day Canadian society, but this awareness itself can sometimes be confusing. Honestly, as a woman who is living with a disability, I am also confused. Oftentimes, I've struggled with knowing what terminology to use and how to approach people whose disability differs from my own. I've also struggled to find appropriate ways to educate people who are curious about my disability. This program hopes to gain a clearer understanding of how to approach the subject of disability and to share various perspectives on this complex subject. Ultimately, I hope that you as listeners will also come away with greater awareness about the lives of people living with a disability. Because, hey, we are all equal. You will be hearing the voices and stories of three amazing women, Gurjeet Dhillon, Rhea Telf, and Elizabeth Davis. Each of these women's lives have been affected by disability in different ways, and each has a unique perspective to share. The first woman you will hear from is Gurjeet Dhillon. 7 years ago, Gurjeet lost 100% of her vision and was challenged to adapt to life as a woman who is visually impaired. She did this with the help of the CNIB, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, where she is still involved both as a student and advocate.
My name is Gurjeet Dhillon. I was born and raised in England, and I moved here to Canada when I was 19. I am 100% blind. In the beginning, when I became blind, it was very, very difficult because, of course, when you have no vision, it's so difficult even to see when there's a step down or you're going over a speed bump. You can't see any of these things at home. You can't tell when the water's hot and you're pouring the water. So I had to do a lot of studying, basically. I had to become a student at the CNIB. And I had a teacher there, and she still is my teacher. She taught me all of my household things that I could do around to learn, how to do my laundry, how to do all of this kind of thing. She taught me all of that. So it's been extremely, extremely difficult. But, you know, you just take every day as it comes. I've been blind for over 7.5 years now, and I am a lot better. I live in my own home now. I'm very happy there. Going out and walking, getting around, I know my few routes that I know. Other than that, mostly I am with my friends. I'm not able to work anymore. So that is a huge disappointment for me because I loved my work. I was a cardiology technologist, but seeing as I am coming along better and I'm doing things, I'm up and around, I'm doing some talks for domestic violence. I keep myself very, very busy. I'd like to save the world if I could. Lots of people have come up and they just ask, are you blind? And I say, yes, I am. Well, what happened to you? And I say, no, I don't want to talk about it. Thank you. And I just walk away because I don't want to talk about in regards to how I turned blind. It's got nothing to do with them. I've got the same heart, the same mind as every other human being. I'm exactly the same, except that I just don't have any vision. My family and my friends, they think of me exactly the same as they are because they know I can get up and go around and make the cup of tea or, you know, do things like that. They know that. But other people, they still look at me as a completely disabled person. It's very dishonorable, let's say. You know, when people look at us and they don't even come towards us, they don't even want to talk to us. Because they look at us and then they turn around and then they look at us again and then they turn around and they start walking. They stare, which is a horrible thing. I hate it. Sometimes actually my friends have told me and my family when I'm walking along, sometimes people, even when they're driving, they turn their heads and they look at me. You know, they're looking at me. They're thinking, oh, she's blind. So you know how I think of it every day? I think, it's all right, I'm a different person. You know, I'm a star. Go right ahead, you wanna look at me? I'm happy. For me, there's a few people that have come in my life that have said, oh, let me do this for you, oh, let me do that for, oh, let me take you there, let me do this, let me do, I don't want their help. I say, thank you very much, you helped me today, But if I need any more help, I will ask you. I'll give you a ring, but thank you very much. My family, of course, are completely different. They know me, and they know that when I need help, I will call them. But I really do not like it when people keep asking me the same words again and again, because it makes it look like I'm not able to do anything. I'm not able to do anything for myself. I need someone with me all the time, which is incorrect, because there's so many things I can do by myself. So I don't need help for everything. But when people ask me, if they're asking me for a certain thing that definitely I need help in, of course I'm going to say, yes, please. That would be wonderful. When I first became blind, that's all I thought of, is why me? Why was I the chosen one? Why would this happen to me? Did I do something bad in life that this is why I was picked? I asked that question all the time to myself. But now I look at myself as just an independent person who I am. When I look in the mirror, I can actually see myself, even though I am visually impaired. But I look at myself and I can still see myself. And I really am the same person. Well, actually, I don't like the word blind. I don't like it at all. It's too strong. It's too basically saying, oh, you're blind. I don't like that. I would prefer, which we do use, we are visually impaired. The word disabled is, again, it's a very labeled word. It's like we're walking around with these labels on our foreheads, you know, that people think, oh, yeah, she's disabled. I don't like that. I don't like that word at all. Every single person on the earth, doesn't matter who we are, if a person does have a disability of some sort, something so simple or something more difficult, something less, we're all the same still. We each of us have a heart, otherwise we wouldn't even be standing here, would we? So we've still got a heart, we've still got our minds. So don't think of us as weaklings, which we are not. We are extremely strong people to continue in life, because life is very, very difficult for everybody. It doesn't matter if you have a disability or not. So we are all the same.
Next, you will hear from Rhea Tell. Rhea is an artist and enjoys taking photographs. She lives on her own as an independent person and has a developmental disability, but that doesn't stop her from living her life to the fullest.
Hi, my name is Rhea Telf. I'm 29 years old. I really enjoy living on my own. I've lived in Thrift for about 5 years. I lived in Delta most of my life. My disability is some cognitive thinking, like sometimes understanding things is a little difficult for me. Being premature, I had a brain hemorrhage, learning disabilities. I also have problems with math a little bit. Although I've gotten pretty good with that, I can pay my own bills and do my own banking and stuff now. I work for myself. I'm an artist. I do artwork. I do photography. For a long time, I painted portraits of myself, self-portraits. And I did that for a few years. I tend to do people, though. I tend to paint people. I like to take pictures of, like, nature and different shapes and close-ups of things. Often, I get frustrated when I was little because I have OCD, mild OCD. And it was very frustrating. I knew something was different about me, but I didn't know what it was. A lot of repetitious behaviors, things like that. So my parents started giving me crayons and paper to kind of encourage myself and to distract myself from whatever I was fixated on. And that was when they discovered that I was actually really good at art. I found school really difficult, and it was really challenging for me in school. I was always in the resource room, and I took it upon myself to learn on my own, to really work on my strengths and my talents, and to really focus on what I was good at rather than focus on my disabilities. I give inspirational speeches on my life story, all my struggles, and going through the school system, having a brain hemorrhage when I was born, and all the stuff that I had to go through to kind of get where I am today. And then kind of combining all that to being pretty successful in my artwork and in photography, my speaking. I did four schools. I give inspirational speeches on my life story, all my struggles, and going through the school system, having a brain hemorrhage when I was born, and all the stuff that I had to go through to kind of get where I am today. And then kind of combining all that to being pretty successful in my artwork and in photography, my speaking. I did four schools. In the Surrey School District, talked for like UBC and Vancouver General Hospital. I've done Skypes in conferences like in New Zealand, then in Canada and the United States. Then I'll be doing some speeches in London later on this year over Skype. My parents were always there for me. They, encouraged me to, you know, express myself through my artwork and put a lot of effort into helping me with my art shows and my public speaking and really helped me with all of my stuff. But I also really helped myself, like, because I had to be determined to learn how to do it. Even though it was really difficult, I prevailed through it and really worked hard at it. Because I wanted to be like, you know, everybody else. I think, quote unquote, normal people, there's a certain level of expectancy for people to be able to reach a certain level. Most people can do this by this age and then by this age. And there's a certain criteria for like schools. By this age, you can do this, or you can do that. For me, that was important to, for the most part, be able to reach that level of achievement, to be able to fit into that normal category of learning. I think people consider me equal. I think that lots of people don't know I have a disability, because mine's, like, intellectual, and I think a lot of people get confused when I don't understand something, like you've told me something a few times and I just don't get it. Then people are like, oh, okay, well, she probably has some sort of disability there. But on the outside, I don't think people really would consider myself having a disability until you really get to know me. I think disability to me is just a word, really. I think that everybody no matter what their disability is, have talents and have things to offer. So I just find it a word. I want people to know that it's important not to label yourself with your disability and to just do your best and, you know, try your hardest and, you know, don't give up.
The last voice on this program you will hear from is Elizabeth Davis. Elizabeth has a disability called fibromyalgia and moved from New York City to Vancouver. She explains what it is like to transition her life from one big city to another and what it is like to live on her own as a UBC student.
My name is Elizabeth Davis. I'm a third-year student at UBC. I'm a dual citizen here, but I grew up in New York City and have been living in Vancouver for the past couple of years. I have fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain disability. When fibromyalgia becomes evident, I guess, when it shows up in people, is usually in girls in their early 20s. At some point in my life, due to a combination of genetic predisposition, environmental stimulus, perhaps an accident, or intense situation that caused the nerves to, instead of being able to deal with crisis and then stop dealing with crisis, the flight or flight experience is just on all the time. So it means fatigue, I feel heavy, I have muscle spasms all the time. I can point out like where all the muscles on my body are just because I can feel them all aching. I started experiencing all this pain about a year ago. What this does is it affects the nerves that go into the muscles and that go into the connective tissue. It's called the fascia, all the stuff in between the muscles, and it gets inflamed because the muscles are inflamed, and then all that stuff, it spirals and keeps going. Since I've gotten to UBC, I've dealt with extraordinary anxiety, depression, back and forth, and my pain has only gotten worse. At the end of the summer in 2013, I had a really, really bad longboarding accident. Since then, all the symptoms of fibromyalgia kicked in. After 3 months, 4 months into last year, January, I went to the hospital because I didn't want to. Went to UBC Hospital and told, okay, you just take some time, send me on your ride. I went through several doctors, that was kind of how it went. Finally found someone very supportive at Health Services who helped push me through with the referrals I needed. I finally saw a specialist in July. Since then, things have been moving amazingly. I now have a psychiatrist, been able to go into Access and Diversity, actually get clarification legally that I use as a disability. I'm now going to a chronic pain clinic. They've been helping me a lot with mindfulness and techniques. A lot of what I've done to deal with my disability is how can I make things more convenient? What can I do to organize my life so that it's less stressful for me to go about things? Because I also forget things all the time. There's a brain fog on the aspect of it. Chronic pain keeps the frontal cortex of your brain constantly active, so that leads inevitably to a tendency to an anxiety, depression, a sense of sensory overload. In New York, you are literally inhabiting the same several square miles as 18 million people and all their businesses, all the stuff they're doing. When I was in high school, I was pretty mobile and I pushed myself very, very hard because I started experiencing my symptoms in high school, but thought like, oh, this is just something that happened. that applies to the inner self as well as the outer self. It applies to how you are as a person as well as how you act as a person. There's a huge community on Tumblr of people called Spoonies, if you've heard of the spoon theory, which is basically in chronic illness, every day you have so much energy and you have so many figurative spoons. So basically, how many spoons does it take you to get up and get dressed? For me, that takes me about 2 spoons, maybe 3 some days. Then how many spoons does it take you to get out of the door and to get to school? That's probably at least another 2. Now, saying I had 10 spoons to begin with, I've already used 5 of those just to start my day. Then, say I have to go to work and do barista things, that'll take up 4 spoons probably, if I'm being realistic. And then I get home, and I have this 1 spoon that I have to stretch over my homework. Maybe I have to get dinner, maybe I'll call up my friend, maybe I try to relax a bit with my boyfriend. But usually, I just wind up lending from tomorrow, and then tomorrow is even harder. And what happens is, you catch up, and then you crash. Because the spoons are only figurative. They're just for how much willpower and how much energy can you put into something. I just want people to know, firstly, that there is a community of people dealing with invisible illness. And it affects people in multitudinous ways. Sometimes mobility is affected, sometimes cognitive is affected, but every single one of these people is very, very strong. You don't have to go above and beyond to succeed. You just have to continue to do what you need to do, what fulfills the things that you need in your life. That's what you have to do. And as long as you can continue to do that and keep trying, because there's always worth in trying, because there's always another friendly face if you reach out to them.
Gertie, Rhea, and Elizabeth's lives are all affected by disability. They all face the challenges of living with disabilities head-on, and each of their experiences represents a great deal of resilience. These are the voices of members of our community. Take a look around you. According to Stats Canada, about 3.8 million Canadians reported having a disability in 2012 and are living with challenges like those of the women in this piece. Some are visible and some are invisible. Increasing awareness about disability was my primary goal for this project. And I hope that the stories shared here have provided you, the listeners, with a new perspective about the diversity of disabilities, the challenges they present, and the strengths of the individuals living with them. Everyone has a different way of living in the world, and everyone is dealing with their own struggles, whether it's a disability or not. As Rhea said, disability is just a word. In my opinion, the cornerstone of this piece is not sympathy, but empathy. We need to increase our curiosity and our awareness about everyone around us. I think it's really important to remember that we are all equal in our right to be respected and understood as individuals. As an unknown author wrote, always remember that you're unique, just like everyone else. If you'd like to listen to this program again and other programs like it, please visit citr.ca. You can check out Rhea Telf's artwork, spelled RIIATALVE, at riatelf.blogspot.ca and riatelf.wordpress.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'm DP Lil, signing off for News 101.
We did have some technical difficulties with that last piece. You will be able to access it in full on citr.ca. Thank you once again to DP Lil.
That's our program for today, December 12th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, please join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Moira Warburton.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. Today's broadcast was produced by Morgan Yee. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
The holiday season is here, and it wouldn't be the holiday season without Operation Red Nose, a designated driver service that lets you celebrate until the party's over, and then return home safely in your own car. The service is easy to use and free. Just call us, and we'll drive you back to your home. For more information, visit OperationRedNose.com. Operation Red Nose, last call before you hit the road.
Calling on a phone,